Hello, everybody, and welcome to this episode of the podcast entitled Reinventing Global Health. The topic today is global health and chronic diseases, and my guest is Dr. Giulietta Gabbiola. Dr. Gabbiola is a clinical professor of medicine at Stanford University. She's an educator for care faculty, teaching the practice of medicine at Stanford Medical School. She's involved in mentoring medical students with their Med Scholar projects with focus on global health outreach program. Her specialty is internal medicine with interest in chronic diseases like hypertension and diabetes. She's a faculty fellow at the Stanford Center for Innovation in Global Health. She practices internal medicine at Stanford Express Care, involved heavily in her foundation, ABCs for Global Health, with a mission to improve chronic disease management and outcomes in Filipinos, in the Philippines, and in the U.S. She was one of the authors of Disrupt, a book by Filipina leaders with the idea that in order to effect change, we must be willing to disrupt the status quo. So true. Most recently, she was instrumental in launching the first medical mobile clinic in Pampanga, in the Philippines, with a vision to promote community outreach programs, continuity of care, education, prevention and research in healthcare. The focus is on improving health outcomes in chronic non-communicable diseases and in decreasing health disparity. Specific target is disenfranchised population, particularly people with chronic cardiovascular diseases. She's now involved with the planning and execution of Stanford Digital Medic in the Philippines, where academic institutions and nonprofit organizations partner with Stanford to enhance digital medical education. So please, Dr. Gabbiola, is there anything you would like to add to this short bio?
No, that's a wonderful rendition of my bio. Thank you so much for that introduction.
Okay, well, great. So let me start with the first question. We will be on from a clinical research and academic perspective. What is the importance of chronic diseases in global health?
I'm glad you're asking that question because I wear those multiple hats. As you know, I'm a clinician practicing basically common outpatient management. So I am still doing full-time at Stanford. And this is an academic practice. So I'm also involved with, partnering with different academicians in terms of improving the health of people and less heavy on research because that's not an area of my expertise, but I'm very interested in being instrumental in encouraging colleagues to look at research in terms of chronic disease management. So in terms of what you're asking, what's the importance of chronic diseases in global health? This is such a loaded question, but let me break it down into a more digestible practical approach. You see, simplicity is key here. So we all understand the threat of non-communicable diseases, which I will also refer to frequently as chronic diseases, and why it should be a priority globally. So throughout the talk, I will be referring to chronic diseases and non-communicable diseases. So what are they? They are known as chronic diseases, referred to a set of disorders that are outside the realm of infectious diseases. They are generally long-term diseases, and they are costly for most countries and for families and individuals. So the disease burden globally had shifted towards chronic diseases. Chronic diseases are the emerging threats globally now, largely due to the aging population and also the increasing risk factors and decline, of course, of the prevalence of infectious diseases until COVID came. So when we talk about chronic diseases, one would commonly think of cardiovascular diseases like ischemic heart disease and cerebral ischemic diseases, cancers, chronic respiratory diseases like COPD and asthma, and diabetes. It's interesting that both mortality and morbidity of chronic diseases are rising. And this is largely fueled by the rising cardiovascular diseases, obesity, and diabetes. From statistics alone, the impact of non-communicable diseases globally is huge. Mortality, for example, I will be simplistic out here and just round out numbers. So I would say the rule of 75%, right? According to the WHO, chronic diseases kills 41 million people each year, which is about 75% of all deaths globally. Of all of these deaths from non-communicable diseases, 75% of them are in low and middle-income countries. And these are the countries that are vulnerable specifically because of lack of resources. So that's mortality. So let's leave mortality and move on to premature mortality. And how is that defined? Of course, in the 20th century, death before 40 is not considered premature. But in the 21st century, people are aging and are living longer. And so death before 70 years old is considered premature. And the threat of non-communicable diseases, the 85% of them are premature. So that's before age 70, right? And then this premature mortality from non-communicable diseases, 85% of them are from low and middle income countries. And 85% of them are preventable. They're lifestyle diseases like cardiovascular diseases, like I mentioned, cancer, chronic respiratory diseases, diabetes, and obesity. So the rapid rise of non-communicable diseases, its increased prevalence, has severe implications, not only to the population health, but also its economic impact. Poverty and socioeconomic status are highly correlated with the common risk factors for non-communicable diseases like hypertension, diabetes, obesity, smoking, and dyslipidemia, making low and middle income countries particularly vulnerable to the cardiovascular burden of chronic diseases. The downstream effect of this burden is in its socioeconomic impact, where people lose productivity, compounding even more the existing financial difficulties of families and individuals. For example, the out-of-pocket expenses, which is so common in most of these countries, push people toward the poverty line when they suffer from these chronic diseases. Because not only that the chronic diseases are so common in this vulnerable population, but the long-term consequences of this and the healthcare costs are costly. So, for example, when a person in a family suffers from a stroke, not only that that person suffers from it, the loss of their productivity, but family members would have to stop working to take care of that stroke victim. Same thing with heart attack and kidney failure. So the cost of that is staggering. As you see in many countries, dialysis centers have expanded and they are overpopulated now. In every corner, for example, in the Philippines, there are kidney dialysis centers. So you will see this emerging in many countries, in many vulnerable countries, the low-income countries in particular. So it is really imperative that research and innovation should be directed to non-communicable diseases. And also these low-income countries are less likely to have infrastructure for early detection and proper disease management and follow-up. So I will stop there because this is really huge and I would like people to digest that for a minute and think about the importance of non-communicable diseases in global health.
Yes, that's very, 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 very clear. But for more clarity, how do you define a chronic disease? When does a disease become chronic? Because we have the example of HIV/AIDS, for example, that became a chronic disease. It was acute at the beginning, but now with the treatment, it becomes chronic. And also COVID. Now we have long COVID that is turning into a chronic disease. So what is the definition?
Well, The initial definition of non-communicable diseases or chronic diseases stemmed out from, like, away from the infectious diseases. As you mentioned, you're right, because of the improvement of the treatment armamentarium, we actually have more progression to chronic diseases for HIV, for example, chronic hepatitis, and now long COVID, right? And these are largely infectious diseases. But when we talk about global diseases for a moment to simplify it, we were mainly talking about cardiovascular diseases in general, cancer, and chronic respiratory diseases like COPD and asthma. Obesity is going up there as well. So
there's a difference between chronic disease and non-communicable diseases. So we will talk about non-communicable diseases. Now, here's another take that I would like to submit to you, is that some people have classified obesity as a communicable disease because it's not a virus, but it's the environment. It's the family, it's the place where they live, where the eating habits are communicated from one generation to another.
I say, you know, it's semantics, right? So what I consider anything that's transmitted environmentally, not just due to pathogens, infectious diseases, I would say no. I would say infectious diseases are communicable diseases because they are transmitted by, you know, organisms, right? So I would probably define that differently. And I would say non-communicable diseases are these diseases that are not transmitted by organisms or pathogens.
Okay. And now, what about the risk factors? For example, if you take racism impacts on the psychological health of many people, and also the physical health. Can it be listed as a risk factor?
For chronic diseases?
Yes.
Are you asking, is race...
Racism is a risk factor because people who are suffering from racism have less access to healthcare, so that the disease can become chronic because they don't get the proper treatment at the right time.
Yeah, obviously, right? So socioeconomic, basically other socioeconomic factors contribute to the chronicity of these diseases. Yes. It is one of the risk factors. And, you know, a lot of those also are vulnerable population, and they are not only that the health literacy of people also contribute to the burden of disease.
Yeah. Okay. So I'm glad we clarified all this. And now we'll move on to the second question. What are the main challenges? What are the priorities in terms of chronic diseases?
Oh, my goodness. There are several. But in terms of, there are several challenges. And if there are challenges, of course, there will be opportunities, right? So this is really not simple to address because there are really several challenges in terms of chronic diseases in global health. So I would think of the first one as these are chronic diseases and are relatively asymptomatic during the earlier phase of their development, right? So people don't feel the symptoms of hypertension until it gets to the consequences of hypertension, which is really largely heart attack and stroke. Right. So people do not feel the acute symptoms, like, for example, shortness of breath, fever, and chills, like in pneumonia or COVID. Right. So, and the markers of vascular damage and inflammation, which predates the consequences of these diseases, are not so obvious. People don't feel the ongoing inflammation in their blood vessels and the vascular damage until they develop their first heart attack or stroke and or kidney failure requiring dialysis. So this is really a massive, massive drain to the resources of every family who would take care of their family members. And sometimes they have to sell their possession. So that's one of the challenges. They are asymptomatic. People don't feel them. And then as opposed to the terms of precision medicine, genomics, stem cell, these are sexy terms. Non-communicable diseases are less sexy. I don't know whether you remember during the time of the 90s, right? So I would say we should change that. We should make non-communicable disease innovation more sexy, so at least we could pay attention to them more. So that's the second challenge. The third challenge is, I think, would be misalignment of funds, right? Current funding and area or focus of interest is towards infectious disease like malaria, HIV, TB, and now, of course, COVID. Countries should rethink this and mobilize funding more on the prevention, risk modification, education, and early diagnosis and timely treatment of non-communicable diseases. So the fourth challenge would be, I say, the very countries who are vulnerable to the risk of non-communicable diseases are the same countries where the government have limited infrastructure, limited universal access, and in terms of screening, prevention, and education, treatment of chronic diseases. And furthermore, these are the countries who are also ill-equipped to face the burden of the consequences of these diseases, further depleting their resources and further fueling poverty in most of those countries. So, for example, low-income countries receive a percentage of their GDP to fund healthcare, like in an order of 0.8 to 4%, as opposed to developed countries who fund their healthcare system in an order of 10 to 15% in developed countries. So in countries with high, and let me just break it down again. So let's just take diabetes, for example. So in countries with high prevalence of diabetes, countries will be expected to spend about 40% of their healthcare budget just on diabetes and its consequences. Whereas in developed nations, they only spend about 2.5 to 15%. Why? Because they have resources and they have infrastructures to actually face the consequences of chronic diseases earlier than later. So I would think that there will be a lot more challenges, and those are the very few major ones in terms of chronic diseases in global health. And of course, when you have challenges, this will create more opportunities for growth, more opportunities for innovation in how we approach disease management and prevention for chronic diseases.
And okay, so in terms of priorities, what do you think are the priorities?
I think in academics and research and clinically, we should invest time, efforts, and resources in training our clinicians, our academicians and researchers to mobilize resources towards non-communicable disease risk, risk stratification and modification, education of not only our clinicians and doctors and healthcare providers, but also education of the public. And then there should be more research in terms of risk mitigation and early prevention. So these are diseases that are so easy to diagnose, and there are many treatments available for this. And it's still hard to grasp why we do not control hypertension, for example, and why we can't control diabetes.
Okay, thank you very much. But from what you just said, it seems to me that the cornerstone is prevention. Prevention at an early stage.
Absolutely. I think prevention and risk modification, right? So a lot of this, as we term them as lifestyle diseases, which means that there are some environmental lifestyle changes that need to happen, like better nutrition for people and more focus on plant-based products, less meat, less fat, less processed food, for example, less salt, less alcohol. And then, so that's better or healthy diet. And then more importantly is increasing activity profile of people, you know, exercise and activities. And right now with the internet and with everything like streaming and video games, people are less and less active. With remote people working remotely, people are on their desk all the time. So I think sitting is the new epidemic, right? So I think people should mobilize themselves and should exercise more. And then, of course, you know, thinking about a better attitude, less stress, better sleep. So I think we should think about this more as priorities.
Yes. I totally agree with you, but here's the big challenge, is behavior change. So how do you change people's behavior? And there is scientific protocols and programs to do that, especially at Stanford. There was one that was made by Deborah Balfance, and she's from Princeton, about 15 steps to change the behavior. And those are generic. They can apply to smoking, can apply to eating habits and so on, exercise. So do you see a trend that this behavior change is implemented with the prevention, with the treatment, with so on? Because without the behavior change, I think, you know, and as you know, chronic treatments, they tend to be abandoned along the way. The longer they last, the more the compliance diminishes. So the problem, as I see it, is behavior change. The gateway for all these interventions is behavior change. What do you think?
I am on board on that 100%. But it is one of the great challenges. Behavioral changes is always a challenge, you know, because people are addicted to processed food, you know, and so behavioral change in terms of other risk factors like smoking and alcohol. And I myself, I'm so, you know, like, it's so hard for me to remove rice from my diet, right? Mm-hmm. And I know that I have to decrease consumption of rice and improve my own behavior. So behavioral changes is such a very challenging way to approach chronic diseases, because people would just want to take a pill, right? So I said, I could eat all the fat that I could eat, and there are some statins to control my lipids. So, and that might not, you know, it's really unacceptable, but that's how people behave, right? So changing that really makes sense, and early mitigation is really key.
Yeah, and on top of that, some nutrients are addictive, like sugar, for example.
Oh, right.
So it's a double challenge.
I know. I keep asking people, the more sugar or starch or carbohydrates that you eat, the more hungry you'll be.
Yes, and people become used to some taste. When you don't add salt, for example, they don't like it. It's like bland. So they get used to salty, and then that's a risk factor for hypertension, of course.
Right, right. And in many countries who are predisposed to hypertension, if you notice, there's a lot of salt in the diet.
Absolutely.
China, India, Philippines, very, very high salt diet in their dietary components. So
Dr. Gabiola, I would like to now to move on and switch to what you're doing. What are the interventions? What is, for example, the place of digital technology in dealing with chronic diseases?
Oh, okay. I'm glad that you asked, what am I doing now? So first of all, let me take you back historically, why this happened. So why we launched our medical mobile clinic, why we launched our telemedicine or the Dr. Graham kit with the app, right? So, and the use basically of digital technology or mobile technology in chronic disease management. So it started when my kids went to college, and I thought that maybe there would be something that I could make a difference. So I started volunteering to medical missions going to the Philippines. Of course, Philippines is a rich bed for medical missions. A lot of Filipinos and their groups, and they infect other people to join them. So we go to the Philippines for medical missions, and other countries like Africa and South America are also rich bed for medical missions, right? So we started with medical missions, and I was involved in it for 5 to 8 years, doing volunteer work for 1 week, where it's so inspirational to go there. And, you know, there will be like 200 of us volunteers, nurses, doctors, teachers, pharmacists, social workers, right? So we all volunteered to go to a community where we see about 5,000 people per day. So what is that? Oh, it made our heart really blossom because it said, oh my God, we could treat 5,000 people, right? So at the end of the day, we're so happy. People are so happy because they were seen by clinicians from the United States. Right. But then at the end of each medical mission, I ask myself, what did we really do? I mean, in terms of surgery, for example, it's great because we do cataract surgery and we do cleft lip and cleft palate surgery, and the kids could smile and their smile is so beautiful after cleft palate, you know, repair. And the older people with cataract, they could see. So that's very, very, you know, fulfilling. But then when I ask myself, what did we do in terms of chronic diseases, which is, as I mentioned, 85% of the people that we see are chronic diseases. I didn't feel that we had done much because we will treat their hypertension. Like we see people running around with blood pressure of 200 over 100 and blood sugars of 400 and 500, and they don't have symptoms. My medical students even comment like, maybe our gadgets are malfunctioned. And then they'll check against themselves and they're just fine. So these people are running around with those high blood sugars and blood pressure. And then we treat them, get it down within a week, and then give them 1 to 2 months supply of medications. After that 1 or 2 months supply of medications, they can't afford to continue it. So what happens? Their blood pressure will go up. So we didn't have follow-up of those people. We did not have education or prevention. And of course, there's no research. So we don't know where we are going and what is our destination. But on a, like, I will probably divide it into a telescope and microscope, right? The microscope is the acute process that we do, the acute intervention. I think it's fulfilling. We treat them, get them out of our, you know, our clinic, and we feel great because we saw a lot of patients. On a telescope view, I don't think we're really impacting chronic disease management. So there we are. That's how we started. And when we started the nonprofit, ABCs for Global Health, it had 4 platforms. The platforms are not just treatment of acute and chronic diseases. Of course, we cannot send people out because they have acute disease, right? So whenever we see people, they come in for every reason, whatever. And it could be respiratory, intestinal parasites. It could be weak and dizzy. But we also see a lot of the chronic diseases. Our focus is chronic diseases, but we cannot really push away people with acute diseases. So our treatment of acute and chronic diseases is there. And that's our first platform. The second platform is prevention of chronic diseases by mitigating the risk factors, as I mentioned, not only mitigating the risk factors, but early screening to prevent progression. And then the third one is education, education of our workers, education of the students that we teach, education of the public. And then 4th is research. So those are the 4 platforms of our medical mobile clinic. We launched our first medical mobile clinic in 2016. And shortly thereafter, my medical students from Stanford piloted the program of digital telemedicine with the use of devices like blood pressure, blood sugar, EKG, dermoscope, and the use of like pulse oximetry, peak flow. So all of those gadgets are in one kit, and the outcome is phenomenal. And my dream is to expand this project because it works. Number 2, it's lower cost. And 3, it will really prevent the downstream consequences of chronic diseases.
Okay. And here's my question. I have 2 questions, actually. One is about the preparation of those missions. In order to impact, you know, maximize your impact, was there any kind of triage that was made before you go to those communities so that you have a limited period of time? So you can only see so many patients. So was there a triage so that you see the people who need your help the most first? And my second question is about all the technology that you mentioned, what are the obstacles to scaling?
Yeah. A great question. So let's start first with the first one, the medical missions, like how we triage, right? So those medical missions are very, very costly. So it's like about $250 million, spent on medical missions per year. And for what outcome? I'm not really sure whether people measure outcomes of those short-term medical missions. So the preparation is huge. Like for my group to come, in order to recruit 150 to 200 volunteers to go to the Philippines, the preparation starts a year before we go. So if we are doing my medical mission now, I'm already preparing for the next year. So I already try to locate the community, the next communities that we're going to do. And then I connect with those people, their leaders, and then pave the way for the planning. So we plan like how many patients would we see, what kind of resources we have to prepare, who are the surgeons who will be doing the surgical stuff. And we line up the people 6 months before, we line up already the people that we have to do surgeries. And for the medical part of the medical mission and dental part, we basically limited to, for example, 5,000 or we limited to usually to 2,000 people, but then 8,000 people would come in that day and we just can't. So we give them out cards, numbers, and those first 2,000 patients will be seen first. And the lines are so long. So
But Dr. Gabriola, this is on a first-come, first-served basis, right?
Correct. But
if you compare this to the emergency room, when patients are coming in the emergency room, there is a triage. There is a process that takes care so the people the most needy are seen first. Is this process taking place by the local people? I mean, triage made by the local people before you come in.
Right. So, of course, the acute cases, you cannot plan, right? Mm-hmm. So for the people that we can plan ahead of time, we tell the leaders of those communities that to give numbers out. Mm-hmm. Of course, when we
here's the thing here.
Right.
How is the number given? Because is it because of relationship, because of family ties, and so on?
Well, those occur a lot. So it's the people that you know, right? So the numbers are given to people they know. But eventually, a lot of people get taken care of. So there is that triaging initially. But the people who present acutely, of course, we cannot triage them because they could present today of an acute appendicitis and we have to take them. So those ones, we have a triage. We have registrations, and like we would have like 10 people just registering. We have 10 people manning the traffic, and we have like 30 to 50 clinicians having their individual tables. And this is in an open space, like in a gymnasium or in a school. So the flow of that is even very, very challenging. But with that, at the end of the day, people really feel good. And that's the value of the short-term medical mission. People feel good that they contributed.
Okay, it's a follow-up question on before I let you speak about the obstacles. Follow-up on the hypertension. When the treatment that you give them for 2 months, 3 months stops, is there a rebound? Does that mean that hypertension is higher than it was before you gave them the treatment?
I'm sure, but we don't know that, though.
Yeah, no, I know.
Yeah, we have the short-term medical mission. When we are done, we're done. And we don't know. We hope that they will follow, because we usually tell them, please be followed by physician. Who knows whether those get followed or not? So that's why I created the nonprofit.
Okay, so now, what are the obstacles to scaling the use of the devices that you mentioned? Because it seems to me that there are so many assets that the people should jump on this.
So the obstacle is the cost, right? So people in the Philippines, for example, especially in the rural areas that we serve, they cannot afford these gadgets. Mm. So like in the kit, if you have a complete kit, including the stethoscope and peak flow, it costs, like our cost would be $500. That's no markup. That's just the cost of getting it. And then there's cost of the teleconsultation and telemedicine, because these are all Bluetooth technology, and teleconsultation and telemonitoring. So the data is based on a HIPAA compliant and, you know, secured cloud, right? So that costs money. So the gadgets and the software cost money. So it's hard to really just get it globally there in the Philippines. So what we have started is one community will have one gadget, and we concentrate on that. And we enlist all the people with hypertension, all the people with diabetes, and we created a registry. I think my dream is like everyone should get it. And, you know, the cost, of course, will go down the more we deploy all those gadgets. So I think the vision is there. Right now, we're just going through the process of like implementing it and showing data of its cost effectiveness.
Okay, thank you. Can you describe a mobile clinic? How does it work? What's the staff involved, the equipment? What are the activities and so on, and also the results that you get?
Yeah. So I would invite people to look at our website. It's called abcsforglobalhealth.org. And you could see the picture of the mobile clinic. When I first started it, I had the concept, I said, the bigger the mobile clinic, the better it is, right? So I have this big 30-footer medical mobile clinic, and the picture you'll see on the ABC for Global Health website. And it has two examining rooms and a middle room that's the intake room, and that's also the outflow room, and that's also where we have the pharmacy. And we have a little bit of a bathroom there as well for our workers and patients. So it has two clinics, and it has an examining table, a small table for the doctor, and two chairs, one for the patient and or family, and or the patient will be on the examining table. And then on the walls, you would have the wall units, the blood, like otoscope, ophthalmoscope, thermometer, and blood pressure machine. And we have a portable EKG machine on each one. We have blood draw and weighing scale, you know, height and weight scale. And basically, that's it. And in the middle part, we have our medications. We have computers on all of them, from the registration to the examining rooms. And we are the only community outreach program in the Philippines with electronic medical records. So we could capture data. So we have like 4 years of data now.
This is fantastic. Do you have also telemedicine capabilities in the mobile unit?
Yes, right now we do. And we actually, so this is interesting because way, way before COVID, some of my medical students created a project to explore the use of these telemedicine gadgets in the Philippines. So that was late 2016, early 2017, where my medical students went to the Philippines to pilot this project and see would it work in the rural areas, right? So, and it did work. But the problem that we had is the internet access, right? So it waxes and wanes. Sometimes we have good internet and sometimes we don't. Now we have pocket internet, so that is a little bit better. Some communities got a lot more of their towers for better reception. So that is better. So we piloted it in 2017 and it worked. It took us a while to get the funding to mobilize, you know, in most communities. So now we have four communities that are hooked up to digital technology devices, and we are getting better and better outcomes. Actually, I was surprised during the pandemic, we had an increased uptake because we were the only providers of care when everyone else was quarantined. Most of the doctors who practice in the community just closed their practice or stopped practicing. They were all scared. And we were the only one who were connecting with the people. So we have an upswing of our visits.
This is great. Now that you have a database Do you have anybody working on the return on investment as compared to what was available before and after your intervention? And the correlate question would be, what are the links between your units and the local healthcare structure?
So it's interesting. I'm glad that you asked that, because that's really a main challenge, right? In the Philippines, partnering with the government or public sector and private sector is very challenging. Why? Because if it's election time, yes, they would like to partner with you. But after the election, that partnership is just really on the wayside. And it's not money to their pockets, so it's hard for them to have the heart to really invest on an innovation such as this to help the people. So that's a challenge. Partnership is a challenge. So we also try to partner with institutions like colleges and universities, and that's going very, very well. We still haven't given up partnering with the government, because I think government should adopt a universal plan for this to address non-communicable diseases. And this is really cost effective. And I think they have to open their minds and hearts that if we could prevent one stroke and one heart attack or heart failure or one kidney dialysis, this is an economic savings. So again, I'm so happy that you asked that, because we're still struggling with adoption, implementation, because of limited funding.
Well, okay, so in that perspective, can you show, you know, graphs and all that, the difference that you're making, the impact you're having in terms of what was available before and what you're doing? Because that's an argument for them, you know, tremendous argument. Say, hey, we're making a big difference here.
Well, it's night and day. It was not available before. You know, so, I mean, none of this was available before, and there was really no impetus to, you know, change the outcome. So this was not available before. And now the people that we followed, for example, with hypertension, if they came in or follow up, we had shown 85% of their blood pressure to target goal. 85%, whopping 85%. I have not seen that any data like that in any country, in any parts of the world. So the key is they need to follow up, right? Yeah. So if they followed up and they got treated and got managed, the target blood pressure to goal was 85%. Mm-hmm. And then another, you know, 15%, for example, or 10%, they improved, but they were not to target. And about 2% were worse. So that's the data that we have, just for hypertension alone. Diabetes is following the same track.
Yeah, understand. This is at the individual level. At the public health level, collective level, you have any kind of statistics, any graphs, any numbers, because people, you know, everything is data.
Yes, we do have that. Unfortunately, because this is an audio, I cannot show that PowerPoint presentation, but we do have on a population, that's on a population level. Those are on all hypertension that we follow. So we divided them in terms of poor follow-up and good follow-up. The good follow-up, we have 85% control of blood pressure to target. On the poor follow-up, we didn't achieve that. We probably achieved maybe 50% improvement of their blood pressure. So I think it's crucial that people, this is, you know, chronic diseases is long term. You cannot just do it in 1 or 2 months. So it's long term, but we could cut the cost. It's costly, but we could cut the cost if we could control their blood pressure. Because for one person that you control the blood pressure, it decreases their risk for stroke and heart attack by so many percent.
Okay. So this is expensive, but how does it compare to the cost of doing nothing?
It's night and day again.
Yeah.
So doing nothing, you'll achieve nothing, right? You'll have more deaths, you'll have more complications, and you'll have more cost. Mm-hmm. But doing something like this one is a lot more cost effective. It really decreases the poverty rate of those people. It will decrease the cost of providing care for every country in the world.
Yeah, so it's another very important point is because it's global health. This is applicable anywhere in the world, right?
Exactly. This is this platform, the mobile clinic technology and telemedicine digital technology is basically scalable and it can be applicable to any parts of the world.
But one aspect also that is important in this type of environment is maintenance. How do you maintain the equipment? You know,
it's the maintenance of the equipment is not really the most costly part of our technology.
No, but access, because when something breaks down, you know, this thing is made in Japan, this thing is made in the United States. How do you get a supply for the thing that broke down?
Well, you just buy the supply. So, for example, if you have the gadget, it's $500, you know, and you prevent a heart attack and stroke, that's nothing compared to having a heart attack or stroke, right? So you just buy the supply. The actual cost for us, the big cost, which is about 60 to 70% is really our personnel, our doctors, our nurses, the driver, the custodian, the coordinator. That's the big expense and the medications.
So how many
medications and our medical staff?
How many doctors, how many nurses in one mobile unit?
Is it one? So one mobile clinic has one doctor, two nurses, a driver, coordinator, and a pharmacist.
You do blood tests?
I'm sorry?
You do blood tests?
We do blood tests. The doctor does it and the nurses would run it and then send it to the laboratory.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
We don't have a laboratory. We just draw the blood and send it to a laboratory. I wish we could do our labs.
Well, you know, there are machines that you can buy and they would run, you put them inside and they give you all the results.
Yeah, they are costly.
Okay, and I know.
It's a cost, yeah. Yeah. We don't have funding for that.
Okay. All right. So now I would like to end the this 1 hour on the trends, the global trends of chronic diseases in global health. What is your perspective on this? Do you see hope, silver lining?
So global trends in terms of chronic diseases or non-communicable diseases. I think I'm not sure how to answer that question, because if you look at WHO and you look at the like, for example, we started with the Millennial Development Plan, I think declared goals or targets are not achieved. This is from each 10 years that they look at this, right? So I'm not sure that we are getting any better in terms of our target goals for non-communicable diseases. But the problem is when these are organized and set for implementation, there is no practicality in the matter. People should talk to the people in the trenches, the people who are actually delivering the care, the people who are actually with the people. I think we should look into that with a microscope and how to improve the way we deliver care direct to the people. I think the trends are not better. Despite all this technology that we have, because I think what we're missing, the missing link is the connection with the people.
Yes. And also, can you touch a little bit on waste? Do you see a lot of redundancy?
Yes. In developing countries, we see less waste. In developed countries like in the US, there is a lot of waste and redundancy. And that's, you know, I capitalize on the waste, for example, an excess that we have from Stanford. And I basically collect all the wasted supplies and stuff and ship them to the Philippines, where every little thing counts and every little thing is used. So in what we do, there's less waste. We basically use everything and anything. In developing countries, I think there's less waste, but in developed countries, there's more waste.
Is there an area where you see that you say that this is what should be done? This is a model that should be followed? I mean, you have yours, but in other examples, in the Philippines or anywhere else?
I think I would concentrate on low-cost, effective care. And I think COVID had shown this, that we have to go to mobile technology for blood pressure and blood sugar management, for example, which are key. I think mobile technology is the way to do it. And mobile technology could reach more people in the rural areas, right? So if you stay away from the Silicon Valley, where, you know, people could pay and people have access. And even that, it's dwindling down, right? So primary care is decreasing. We need more and more primary care. And this is the way to go to basically improve and help mitigate the lack of access anywhere, even in developed countries. So I think digital technology should be embraced and it should go everywhere and anywhere.
So let me end up with what's next for you? What is your next focus?
Oh, the next focus is for me to really just scale this up. I would not go anywhere else. This is it. And, you know, to help these disenfranchised people to improve their health and well-being, and hopefully to improve their quality of life. So I think my goal is plain and simple, improve everyone's quality of life and access.
One last question. What is your advice for students that would like to engage in global health?
I think have a heart to serve, because I think when you serve others, it serves yourself more. It's probably a better solution to prevent burnout, because it's so fulfilling to serve others. I think you have to find in your heart the way to do it, and also find some time to, you know, use your resources to help others.
Thank you very much, Dr. Gabriola. Thank you for this very enlightening, eye-opening, stimulating talk, and for the candor of your reply answer to me. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Jan, for inviting me. It's really a great opportunity to spread the word and, you know, the impact of non-communicable diseases.
Thank you so much. And to everyone, I will see you for the next session, which will be on healthcare research in global health.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.